Inside Lacrosse Podcast.
Inside Lacrosse Division One Recap Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined once again by Dan Flynn. And as we jump out of the gates, I want to say thank you to the thousand or so folks who downloaded and listened last week. We appreciate the support, particularly for the return for the 2016 season. That being said, we did call for some audience participation at the end of the podcast, and I didn't get any.
I got a couple. Okay. A couple emails from relatives, more or less. My brother-in-law, who is a huge podcast fan and basically an expert in the podcast listening, gave me some good feedback. And we will be implementing some of his ideas over the course of the season.
Perfect. Well, Dan, we are experiencing a little bit of what most of college lacrosse experienced this past weekend in terms of the scheduling adjustment. Yeah. We're recording on Monday afternoon, but instead of the cozy confines of the Inside Lacrosse office, we are overlooking the Flynn family fireplace.
Yeah, we got a little fire going. It's snowing outside right now, and we figure for our dear fans, we would get this in on our regularly scheduled time and place of Monday afternoon.
That being said, Inside Lacrosse offices are closed for President's Day. We hope that you are all honoring our forebears in an appropriate way. We are going to continue this conversation by talking about another holiday, which was Valentine's Day, yesterday. Did you have a great Valentine's Day?
I did. It was nice. Not very romantic when you have a 7-week-old baby and a very active 2-year-old running around the house on a Sunday when we don't really have any childcare. But it was fun, and my wife's parents came over, and we went to brunch. It was very nice, and I think we had a really nice dinner.
Valentine's Day is not the only holiday that was yesterday, because it was also Super Sunday in the Barclays Premier League.
It was a wonderful Sunday. That was part of the issue yesterday. Started off on a great foot with my team winning a game that started at 7 o'clock in the morning. So I was up at 6:30 preparing for the game.
So you're an Arsenal fan.
Yes, I am.
I'm a Tottenham Hotspur fan.
Yeah, sworn enemies.
For those of you that don't know and don't follow, that puts us at opposite ends of the spectrum. But let's talk about how we got here real quick. So how and why are you an Arsenal fan?
I wasn't much of a soccer fan before I began working at Inside Lacrosse. But when I got there, it seemed like everybody was a soccer fan. You, Schaefer, AB, Sweezy, John Brand, going back, would always be talking about soccer, and I was missing out. And the more I found out about the way European soccer works in terms of the economics, the business decisions of it, it was fascinating to me. So then about the same time, Bill Simmons, sports guy, was looking for a team too, and he went through a lengthy process with his readers who gave him lots of suggestions and in a way to pick a team. And I came to the conclusion that Arsenal was my team for many reasons that seemed to make sense to me. And I've been following them since then. And it's one of those things, the more you put into it, the more you care, the more your interest level is, the more you get out of it. And I've become a diehard supporter and watch every game, much to the chagrin of my family.
That being said, yesterday was a day that paid off. That was one of those days that. So to set the table, there were, you know, the table is actually exactly the term that we're setting. So the Barclays Premier League is organized by, there's no playoff structure. So you accumulate points over the course of the season, similar to the way that they do it in the NHL, where you get a point for a tie. And obviously in the NHL, it's an overtime loss and 3 points for a win. Yesterday was a rare day, Sunday was a rare day in the sense that all four teams, and there's an important delineation there. If you finish in the top four of the Barclays Premier League, you qualify for Champions League play the subsequent season, and that's a financial windfall for your club. Leicester is currently leading the Premier League, and that is an unbelievable miracle-style story.
They were 5,000-1 odds in August to win the league. 5,000-1.
And they played Arsenal, who was tied for third place, tied for second place, but in third due to goal differential with Tottenham. And Tottenham was on the road against Man City, who was in fourth place yesterday. So your alarm goes off at 6:30, and about 2.5 hours later.
Yeah. So pure joy, 2.5 hours later, agony beforehand. I'm trying to turn my 2-year-old onto soccer. She gets up early. So Saturday night, in the mail on Saturday, our Arsenal shirts arrive. So she slept in her shirt. I slept in mine. And I woke her up. We watched the game together. And she doesn't really, 10 minutes into it, she's like, I want to watch Shrek. I said, no, got to hang in there a little bit longer. So Arsenal gets a questionable penalty call, and their star for Leicester, Jamie Vardy, hits a goal to make it 1-0, and it's an uphill battle for Arsenal. They do get a man sent off.
They being Leicester.
Leicester.
So they're playing down a man.
And Arsenal's up, and they manage to score a goal to make it interesting. Really dominated play. It helps when you have a man advantage. But then at the very end, basically the last play, extra time, with the last play, the ref's like, okay, you get a set piece, and you can one more play. A guy heads it in, and they win on the last play of the game. It was ecstasy,
yes,
in the Flynn household.
So I would say that the way in which you came to be an Arsenal fan is probably the way in which 50% of the United States came to be a fan of their club, just choosing. And I think Bill Simmons probably helped a lot of people do that. And it happens cyclically after every World Cup. I think that how I became a Tottenham fan is the way in which about 50% of the rest of the American population becomes a soccer fan of a particular club, and that's through FIFA. So Edgar Davids is the name of a Dutch midfielder who has since retired. He had dreadlocks and astigmatism, so he wore these awesome yellow glasses. And he was a part of the intro sequence of the 2003 FIFA game. At the time, he played for Juventus, then he went to Inter Milan, and then he went to Tottenham. And I followed all the way through, and then stuck with Tottenham once he departed and went back to the Netherlands. Being a fan of Tottenham has been quite a ride, given that they are not routinely among the elite in English football. But this has been a very satisfying season, as they've emerged as the best defensive squad in the Premier League, and exhibited that in taking a 1-0 lead. Man City, the hosts, came back and tied it at 1, and then in the 82nd minute, getting the game winner. And the only thing I wanted to communicate about this, and we'll summarize and start talking about lacrosse here in a second, is that the difference between soccer and lacrosse is the heights and depths of the emotion. So when Tottenham went up 1-0, I felt so good. When Man City scored to tie it, I felt so horrible. And then when they scored to win, it was, I mean, I just, there are so many goals scored in lacrosse that you can't feel. It's rare that the pits and the valleys and the peaks and the valleys are that high and that low. It's much more cardiac arrest type, EKG style emotions.
And one goal can really change your outlook. You know, it goes from we have a comfortable 1-0 lead, or a 2-0 lead in soccer is pretty comfortable. They score that one goal, then you're on the edge of your seat going, oh geez, here it goes. They we're desperate. So it's it was a good Sunday. It's rare that you're that excited at 8:45 in the morning on a Sunday morning, so it was a good start.
And it was a good weekend sports-wise. Certainly for the sport of lacrosse, one that will long be remembered. There's been tons of content on InsideLacrosse.com all weekend about Hampton's debut. And for all of the credit that the Hampton Athletic Administration deserves for the choices that they've made since, dating back to August 2014 through their announcement in May 2015 up until their first game on Saturday, you know, really it was SportsCenter being on the road, being on campus, that escalated this story into a stratosphere that, honestly, I didn't know that the sport of lacrosse could attain.
It was a fantastic day for Hampton, their players, their administration, but really for the sport, as you said, you know, showing the diversity, the growth of the game. It was a significant day, and the fact that ESPN did it the right way and was there was something that will go a long way for the sport.
Well, you know, there are a couple of highlights. I think that, you know, those of you that, like me, had an opportunity to watch the SportsCenter coverage, I think, you know, for a long time, will cherish things like Jim Brown's interview in which he talked about his close connection with the sport. You know, I was particularly I found it particularly gratifying the way in which the Hampton student body and I presume local young lacrosse fans filled out the table behind the SportsCenter desk. It was a college game day type atmosphere, the types of things that lacrosse fans have been imagining for years, and to see it come to fruition, particularly in a unique situation and circumstance like that, was really, really remarkable. And I think that, you know, one of the things that's important for lacrosse fans is that this isn't a ride that's over. Even though the game was not televised, ESPN cameras were there, highlights were aired later, highlights will be aired both of the segments that were produced over the course of the SportsCenter show, as well as the highlights of the game in subsequent ESPNU lacrosse broadcasts over the course of the rest of the spring. And I think that that's one of the things that continues to shine the spotlight, the positivity of this story on the sport, and something that I think will be very meaningful down the road as we move forward.
And a shout out to Roberts Wesleyan, who, you know, took the chance of playing a contest against Hampton in the first game. Somebody had to do it, but a small Division II program in Rochester, and a good publicity for them, and you know, a good statement.
So, you know, moving on, the other big storyline of the week was all of the rescheduled games. I believe that there were 8 Division I men's games that were moved off of Saturday, either onto Friday to be in front of the Arctic Blast that was heading southward over the course of Saturday, or moved to Sunday when the winds were supposed to die down and weather was supposed to be a little bit more manageable. I believe even one, a Monday morning matinee, Richmond topping Fairfield in Connecticut 11-10. You know, Dan, this is something that you can't say we didn't see coming. We put it on the cover of the February issue of Inside Lacrosse magazine. You, as we established last week, have worked in college athletics. How annoying is it to have to reschedule a game like this and do so in this volume, knowing that the likelihood is that you're probably going to have to do it another time or two over the course of your season?
Yeah, it's a headache. And, you know, Hopkins UMBC game moved to a Wednesday at the end of March. Why couldn't they have just put it there in the first place? I'm looking forward to going to that game on Wednesday, March 30th. It's really a headache. It's not just the teams that are involved. There's the officials. There's here's an example.
The parents.
Towson's playing Mercer on a scheduled game for Saturday. So Mercer's got to fly up for that game, I'd imagine. They have hotels. They have to schedule everything. Towson may have had a home basketball, women's basketball game, or their men's basketball team could have been playing, or there could have been other sports that are playing. And you just have to shift so much stuff around because you know it's going to be cold in February. You're almost hoping that you get a rare nice day rather than what should be expected. So there's a lot of logistics that go into play, and it just doesn't make sense that people are playing a good chunk of their schedule before March 1st.
And then the last news item from the week, another, you know, we talked about this, another early February game that probably shouldn't be played in early February, but Johns Hopkins went to Annapolis to take on the Naval Academy and took home a 1-goal double overtime victory. But it was not without controversy, and I don't want to talk about the calls in particular, but I want to talk about the idea of talking about the calls. So to end regulation, Chris Fennell was flagged for an unnecessary roughness penalty. Hopkins held onto the ball, no faceoff started. Shout out to John Connors, who made two unbelievable saves to keep the midshipman alive. And then, not a similar play, but a similar situation to end the first overtime period, Matt Reese was incorrectly flagged for an unnecessary roughness. Johns Hopkins started the second overtime with the ball, and Shaq Stanwyck ended the game with a nice overhand.
Now, when you say incorrectly flagged for the call,
I'm not
questioning the call by the official. You're saying it was a different guy. He was 5 yards away and was put in the penalty box.
Correct. Yeah. So there was a lot of conversation on social media. Folks watching the web stream of the game talking about whether or not the calls were the proper ones. Inside Lacrosse tried to package that conversation into one post, posted it online. It was highly interacted with post. And I guess my question is, what is your attitude towards, are you the type of guy that second guesses officiating as a fan, as a sports fan?
Yes and no. I think most of the time the referees do a great job. There's only three guys on the field. They want to get the call right every single time, and it's tough. I think in that case, what a lot of us witnessed, at least the way I did, I'm watching it on my phone, and from the top of the Navy Marine Corps stadium press box on my phone, I couldn't see a foul at first. And then watching it again, Lacrosse Film Room cut that up and did a nice job of it. Watching it on a day later on my computer, I'm like, oh yeah, it looks like that could have been a foul, But I think a lot of the controversy, some of the questioning came from watching it immediately. And then also when you're watching a web broadcast, you can't see the replays. Mm-hmm. Or some, they don't have the capability of showing a replay from different angles or spotlighting something. So it's being able to watch webcasts is great. And great for the sport, but at the same time, it is, you get what you get.
Yeah. Well, I mean, my attitude is that, similar to you, I think, referees are in a competition, not with each other, not with either team, etc., but they're making decisions and analyzing situations in the heat of a competition. It's not an easy thing to do. But that being said, their choices and their analysis is not to go unquestioned or unexamined, and that's what we tried to do. Got a couple of folks that disagreed with our decision to do so, and that's why I wanted to make it a topic for our podcast.
But also, our job is to let fans talk about it, get conversation going about the game and the sport. So we're also serving the fans as well as the game. So,
well, to the games.
To the games.
For the second and only second consecutive week, we will not be munching on chips and guac.
Yes.
Those of you that listened to us the first time under, we'll maybe remember our analogy to the men in Blazers and their cracking of Guinness. And, here we are in your house. I'm actually a little disappointed, Dan, that we didn't get some homemade guac for the podcast.
I've got two avocados back on the counter. Well, I can make this happen.
So we talked about this being a Chipotle sponsorship opportunity, but it is a well-made point.
Yes.
By Amy Weinstein-Flynn, sales director for Inside Lacrosse, that Haas Avocados, they had a Super Bowl ad. Maybe we just go straight to the source on this one.
Yeah. Good. It would make at least one person in our office extremely happy if we got some avocados coming.
Shout out to Ash Mack. Let us start in Durham, North Carolina, because they were the team that played two games in 3 days. And the number 3 Blue Devils emerged victorious both over High Point and Lehigh. Took care of business against the Panthers, I think, in large part thanks to presumptive Tewharton favorite, if not one Tewharton finalist, likely candidate, Miles Jones, who had 2 goals and 4 assists. Jack Bruckner had 4 goals to demonstrate his wing shooting capability. Deemer Class had 4 goals as well. And then they turned around and took on the Lehigh Mountain Hawks. This is a game that I was able to watch a little bit more closely. Wasn't able to watch any of the High Point game, but I was surprised. It felt like the game was never really in doubt, but it also felt like Lehigh never thought they weren't going to win, or at least couldn't come back and win. I was really impressed by Kevin Casisa's squad's ability to respond, particularly after falling behind early, having a relatively substantial, I believe it was a 6-2 deficit at halftime.
9-3
deficit, yeah, at halftime? Okay, then it was 6-2 earlier in the game as well. But even in this halftime interview, he seemed, I don't want to say upbeat, but not, beaten down. And by he, I mean Kevin, and felt like, his team was going to be able to find a way to respond.
I agree with you. I watched that game. I watched a lot of that game. It didn't seem like it was ever in doubt. But Lehigh really fought hard, wasn't going to be blown out, and just kept coming after him. It could have been a little bit of Duke's legs getting tired after 2 games in 3 days. But I was impressed with Lehigh as well, and I think we've talked to Kevin Casisa, is one of the fine young coaches in our sport, And I liked his team. I liked watching his team play and what they were doing.
I want to, you know, throw out one of my concerns for Duke going forward. Not in the sense that, you know, can Duke be better than what they were last year, but really in the sense of if they get to the semifinals, are they a legitimate national championship contender? And it's kind of a combination of 2 points. So essentially at this point, when I look at them, I say, man, they're a little bit small offensively. And by small, I mean small in stature. And it starts with Case Mathias, who I think has dealt with this criticism his entire career. There was one play in which he took a cross-crease slide from a short stick yesterday and got put right on the ground. He managed to hold onto the ball. One possession later, he went straight to the goal. And 2 possessions later, he scored. So it's not to say that he hasn't figured out a way to overcome this. But then to be surrounded by, you know, Demir Klass, who is thick but not tall and not, you know, impressive, overly impressive physically. You know, Jack Bruckner, to me, looks like he's gotten even a little bit thinner than he was last season. And Chad Cohan is another one of those kind of water buggy type offensive midfielders. Guterding and Miles Jones are really the only two over...
Miles Jones makes up for all those dudes.
You're absolutely right. But here's my second point, which is that when you look at how senior-heavy their offense is with Klass and Jones and Mathias, if Duke is going to... You know, this is not a team that's building necessarily just for 2016. Duke has won 3 national championships in 5 seasons because of their continuity as a program. You can start to see the seeds of the next generation of or maybe the next iteration of main offensive contributors for the Blue Devils emerging, and it's from that second midfield. Brad Smith got his first collegiate goal. Jake Seau and David Gill, 2 sophomores, round out the second midfield. Those guys are physically imposing, and I feel like that top 9, you know, has a lot of matchup advantages in it. The question I have is whether or not the second midfield can produce enough to the point where they, you know, start to, you know, really assert themselves towards the end of the season. I think that was a question that maybe the Duke coaching staff had. You know, in his post-game comments, Coach Shinowski talked about how playing 2 games in 72 hours is a function of finding out who they are. We're going to go roll the ball out and figure it out. When you do that, you force a lot of your bench to play in ways that you don't if you play once a week. And I thought that, you know, we started to see a little bit about where the seeds of who Duke is going to be offensively, both towards the end of this season, most importantly, and beyond as well, start to emerge a little bit against Lehigh.
And Donowski's done a fine job with that over the years of not taking, if there's a way to say this, the regular season too seriously. He tries to set his team up for a run in May. And it's been extremely successful, and I think that's what he's doing now. And games like this are opportunities to go a little bit deeper on your bench and get guys some run.
So one of our weekly features is going to be noting a broadcast quirk. And so this one that I happened on was in the Duke-Lehigh game, and it's really more a question for the audience because I put it out to a couple of the folks that I know are watching this game. So the color commentator for Duke's broadcast was, I know this about him, he was a Duke lacrosse alum, and his first name was Jack, and I believe it was Jack Rowe. I mean, that, you know, the candidate pool there isn't exceedingly wide, but the thing that was most interesting to me about that is, it's got to be pretty cool to call a game with your brother playing in it, right? Yeah. And, you know, if it was indeed Jack Rowe, shout out and get in touch, because I want to ask you a couple questions about what it's like to call a game when your brother's taking a lot of face-offs.
Okay. Terry, moving on, let's talk about a few of the more games, right? So Michigan hosted Colgate and got a great win.
Yep.
Really good win.
Yeah, so Wolverines at home in Oosterbaan Fieldhouse. They were coming off of a disappointing 20-10 result versus North Carolina last week. We talked about it. Gerald Logan got pulled at halftime. Colgate making their debut. You know, obviously it's cold in Hamilton, New York. You tend to, I guess, kind of get running a little bit later. They played on Sunday, and the Wolverines came away with 9-8 victors. I think that, you know, Jerry Logan bounced back. There's no question about it. Patrick McCune was in attendance at this game for Inside Lacrosse, and he started his analysis with that, you know, pointing out that Logan had a couple of nice saves early, also had a couple of nice saves late to help secure the win after Colgate started to make a comeback and close close the deficit, but he finished with 15 saves. You know, and certainly in a one goal game, you can point to that as being the difference. The second element that I think it's one of those questions that now that Michigan's in year five, you know, you start to wonder, you start to scratch your head a little bit about, man, were these some decisions that should have been made a long time ago? Kyle Jackson has been on a scoring tear since moving from midfield to attack. He's already their program record holder for goals, but he looks like he's going to be a 50-goal scorer this year for the Wolverines. And, you know, I've always... So through the 2000s, I had this theory that the most difficult position to recruit to for a new program was that goal-scoring attackman. Opening up Canadian box players as a fertile recruiting ground shifted that paradigm for new programs, and I thought that the most difficult thing to recruit was, I would just characterize them as big dodging midfielders, but essentially any player that can draw a slide consistently. And so, you know, I've talked about this in the past with a number of coaches at new programs, and so from that mindset, I can understand the idea that if Kyle Jackson is our best offensive player, we should have him running out of the midfield, drawing slides and making plays that way. But when you see the production that he's put up at the attack position, you wonder whether or not, man, could he have been doing this all along?
Yeah, I mean, he's 4 goals this week, 4 goals last week against Carolina. He's off to a fantastic start. What about Colgate's attack? Looked pretty balanced.
It did, and obviously when you graduate Ryan Walsh, that's going to be a question mark. And I think that Anthony Abadesa was a phenom freshman last year that a lot of people expected to... It's interesting. When a freshman attackman emerges in a quarterback type position, I think that there is always a certain level of security that the coaching staff feels going forward, because you know that you have your decision maker on the field. He's got a lot of experience, but on the other hand, this side of it is, well, it doesn't necessarily mean that he's not prone to young players' mistakes. Not being able to watch this game, I can't say for sure what level that was, but here's the fact, is that he was limited to one assist, and yet they got 2 goals from Chase Wedich, 2 goals from Peter Donato, and I think that as you said, well spread out attack burden, goal scoring burden, is something that Colgate can build on going forward. To me, what was a little bit more disconcerting was that Michigan, you know, a team that was pretty efficient defensively against North Carolina despite the stats, I'm sorry, that's not true at all. They were efficient offensively, despite the stats. Michigan, who I think struggled defensively against North Carolina, was able to limit Cam Williams, Colgate's leading midfielder, to only 1 goal.
In a matchup, maybe the biggest matchup of the two highest-ranked teams this week, how about those Greyhounds?
How about those
Greyhounds?
Going down
to Charlottesville and getting a key win in emphatic fashion.
I would say that they put a hurt on the Virginia Cavaliers. You know, before we totally move on from the Michigan Colgate thing, there's one point that I want to make. It's a correlation between Loyola's win over Virginia, and that is that, you know, you look at some of these statistical categories, and it's not as if Colgate was that outplayed. The difference is that they only lost by 1 goal. So the fact that, you know, Colgate outshot Michigan 42-28, whereas Virginia outshot Loyola 40-33, well, that wasn't a 9-goal margin,
yeah.
You know, and Colgate shot better than the 10% that the Virginia Cavaliers did. So this was a game that I paid the closest attention to on Saturday. I'm battling two contradictory thoughts.
What are they?
The first is this Loyola 2012 and 2014 that recaptured its transition offense, its defense to offense threat? And Grant Lamone looks so much like Jack Runkle. They have a guy in the net that eats up balls, eats up low-angle shots. He made 14 saves and only let in 4 goals. So that's one side of it. The other side of it is it's actually like also in and of itself a bifactored point. The first is Virginia not very good, or is Virginia okay, but they're going to be a lot better than they are right now? So how excited to get about Loyola, I think, is a question that a lot of people, particularly those who are voting in the media poll, the Maverick Cascade Inside Lacrosse media poll, which debuted its first in-season update Monday morning on InsideLacrosse.com, asked themselves, and I think you had to counterbalance it with, how bad is Virginia?
couple of stats really stood out to me. To hold that Virginia offense to four goals was surprising, but they had 40 shots. They gave up four goals against 14 saves. 22 shots. 22 out of 40 shots not on cage. The shooting efficiency is terrible.
Yeah, and you know, you like to see that shot on goal percentage right around 60%, yeah. And then your actual shooting percentage between 25 and 30%. Virginia's shot on goal percentage was between 40 and 50%, and their it was 45%, and their actual shooting percentage was 10%. You're not going to win very many games if you do that. And it's interesting because Loyola had, for you know, that 2012-14 run, developed a reputation for being a high pressure, don't slide very much type of defense. I saw a little bit more in the way of, I wouldn't call them junk looks, but sophisticated, complex style of play. And I thought that they were a little bit more willing to play longer possessions, defend longer possessions, more in the Maryland-Notre Dame style than in that peak Loyola style. And so while I would say that they were aggressive defensively, I would say that they were aggressive in getting the ball out of their own zone once they got possession. I felt like they were content to let Virginia offensively play themselves into the end of possessions, where it felt like Virginia took a fair amount of shots out of frustration, meaning shots that they weren't, you know, you can tell the difference between a shot where it's like, I don't have any other option than to shoot the ball. It's either going to go in, get saved, or go wide, and we're going to retain possession, versus the entire action, the last 30 seconds of what we've been trying to do is setting up for me to take this shot. I thought their best goal of the day was Ryan Conrad's, where he just said very clearly to himself, you know, I've got 3 yards of space. I'm going to step into a big overhand 14-foot shot, and he scored his first goal. I thought that Ryan Conrad and Greg Cahoolen were the only guys that looked like they were playing offense confidently for Virginia on Saturday against Loyola.
Yeah, I think Virginia will be okay. You know, in a lot of other facets of the game, they outplayed Loyola. They won a significant amount of faceoffs, you know, 10-7.
Which is a huge element for Virginia. First, because they traditionally struggle, and secondly, because I think that there's some belief Graham Savio is among the better faceoff guys in the country.
And they won the ground ball battle 39-32. So they'll be okay. I think Loyola played.
But what is okay?
I think Loyola was better that day. Loyola might be better than we thought they were. And we'll see how UVA does when they go up to Drexel this week in a game that will show us a lot.
And that's the question, is that, you know, for Virginia, okay is quarterfinals, Final Four. This is a team that you can realistically imagine struggling to get to 500 and qualify for the playoffs, particularly if they continue their woes in the ACC.
Yeah, and the ACC is a tough league. It's a tough league. There's no easy outs. Speaking of an easy out, one that almost got clipped is Air Force in Denver.
Yeah.
A close game, one goal game.
And, you know, there were a couple of games this weekend where you were really surprised by the comebacks. Maybe not surprised, but games that seemed like they were in control. I mean, one that stands out to me was Bellarmine had an 11-1 lead on Robert Morris. A Robert Morris team that had gotten thoroughly handled against Penn State a week prior. Bobby Mote cut it to 11-10 before Bellarmine held on for the victory. And then another one, Hobart took a fourth quarter lead against Penn State after coming back from a deficit. And the Nittany Lions needed a big fourth quarter in order to win that one going away. Air Force was able to use a nice third quarter comeback after, which is notable primarily because of how much they struggled in the third quarter against Navy after taking a 5-2 lead into halftime. And basically make it nip and tuck down the stretch. You know, I thought that there were a couple of things to take away from this one statistically. Another game that was not live streamed because of a change of venue out in Colorado Springs. That, however, was not weather related. First thing, Alex Reddy looks like a legit starter in goal for Denver, making 13 saves in his D1 debut. He obviously played against the U.S. national team and was impressive there. Sticking with first impressions, Nate Morano, Under Armour All-American, lefty. I drew the analogy between him and Mark Matthews when, you know, their number, their stature, their left-handedness, if not their nation of origin, looked very similar to one another. Murano basically won this game, basically separated the Pios with the game-tying goal and the game-winning goal down the stretch. And then the last thing was that Trevor Baptiste is heading into this season probably the best-known quantity in college lacrosse and, by extension, potentially the best asset in college lacrosse. However, he was not, while good, overly dominant in this game. This is not a 21 of 23 performance from Trevor Baptiste. I believe, you know, at 16 of 23, he's at 60%. You know, this is a guy that's capable of going over 90% when everything's clicking for him. You know, I think that if he had been that good, the margin would not have been one goal. You know, the fact that Air Force was able to scrap out a few was the reason that they were able to stay in the game.
I'm sure Coach T will take Murano turning into another Mark Matthews.
I would assume so, yeah. There is another point that I want to drive here, and it's similar to the Duke one, which is that when you looked at Denver heading into the season last year, the thing that gave me the most confidence is that their top nine was so good and so experienced. When you look at what Denver has on their roster, they're really six players deep offensively right now. They, like the Blue Devils, are going to have to emphasize developing depth offensively over the course of the season.
And they'll have a chance to do that for sure.
For sure. Yeah. Including against each other in a game that we will talk about shortly.
Yes. So on to another topic. Twitter follow of the week, Terry. Who is your guy?
Well, so last week we talked about Christian Sweezy, who continued his run of dominance. So make sure that you follow Sweezy Lacrosse on Twitter. But this is a little bit of an oldie but a goodie in the sense that Dave Cottle has been lighting Twitter up for 5 years. And those that have had an opportunity to experience Dave Cottle either from a media, you know, capacity or know him personally or even just watch him on the sidelines could probably ascertain or know for sure that he's a really entertaining guy. He frequently makes points that, when I speak with him, make me scratch my head and say, wow, that's really interesting. And the thing that I like the most about him is that he is really candid on Twitter. He tends not to pull punches, whether it's talking about the structure and organization of Major League Lacrosse, talking about his observations of what he's seen on the field in college lacrosse games, you know, all the way down to his political outlooks. That being said, on Friday evening, as I was going to bed, turned on North Dakota versus Denver hockey, and I noticed that both teams' players had their names on the back of their jerseys. And I sent out what I would call an innocuous tweet, basically making the point that college lacrosse coaches and college hockey coaches tend to be cut from a very similar cloth. So why is it that players' names on the back of their jerseys is an acceptable aspect of college hockey culture, but not college lacrosse culture? Coach Cottle provided an answer, and Patrick McEwen, who I've already cited once in this podcast, engaged in a long conversation about the nature of identifying the individual over the team in sports. It was a fascinating debate. I recommend that you take a gander at it after you've followed Coach Cottle. But Dan, I'm interested in your take on this debate. Where do you come down on the play for the name of the front on your jersey, not the name on your back? That being said, in order to not play for the name on the back of your name has to be on the back of your jersey.
I'm a believer in the, you know, the team first aspects for sure, but it's better for fans if their name is on the back. It's easier to tell who's who. Obviously, that's how it got started, and I don't see what the problem is with it. In fact, I would endorse that as something that I'd like to see more of.
So I believe right now are three Division I men's lacrosse teams that put their players' names on the back of their jerseys. Who Virginia is one. Michigan is another. Actually, I think there are four, because I believe Brown has their names, if not on all of their uniform sets, on some of them. And somebody tweeted at me that Stony Brook started doing it last year as well. Duke had done it in the past, has not done it in recent years. My relationship to this issue, I think, is not unique, but this is my point of view. This is kind of what I come back to whenever I talk about this. And it's that the high school football team that I played for we did not have the names on the back of our jerseys in the regular season. But when we qualified for the playoffs, we got our names on the back of our jerseys. It was a tradition that was started when I started following the program when I was 4 years old, and the team made the playoffs for the first time. And so when my team, my junior year, was on the precipice of not making the playoffs, breaking a streak that had run from 1988 to 2001, I was pretty distraught, not just at the fact of not making the playoffs, because I really wanted to have the name of my back in my jersey. I'm telling you, it was like, you know, I wasn't somebody that got on the field, but it mattered that much to me. And we did qualify, and I can guarantee you that one of the easiest purchases I've ever made in my entire life was buying both the white and blue jerseys that were on that had Foy on the back of the back panel of the jersey, and I still have them today, which I know is that still okay. Having them is, you know, that's not right. Necessarily a shining moment, but so my point is that it provided a source of motivation that while a coach could justifiably say it shouldn't take that for you to want to make a playoffs, like, those are the nooks and crannies of a program's identity that can help separate your team's mindset from something that might be just a step inferior to that.
I don't think it's something, it's so common in other sports that it is unusual that you don't see it more in lacrosse, for sure. Let's move on, Terry, to the week ahead. Exciting list of games. Hopefully we'll play some of these and they won't get moved around. But there's a great list of a lot of ranked teams getting together and the debut of a couple teams that we haven't seen. So first game, Duke versus Denver in the Cobb County shootout.
Yeah. So, you know, our friends down in Georgia at LB3 are putting on this event as they have for each of the last two seasons. And this is a rematch of what was a highly anticipated game heading into last season.
Sure.
One in which I remember talking to Trevor Tierney afterwards, and, you know, I remember talking about Trevor Baptiste, and it was one of those moments where you're just like, yeah, I mean, we had Denver at number one heading into the season, but this really helped feel like it was bona fide. In this matchup, you know, we've already talked at length about both of these two teams and how I think one of the most fascinating developments that each is going to undergo is their search for depth. But as it relates to the outcome of this particular matchup, the first thing I'll say is that it doesn't matter, meaning that the loser of this game is no worse for the wear. The winner of this game is fortunate in the sense that they can count on a win that's almost assuredly going to be a top five win at the end of the season, which will be very, you know, could theoretically be very pivotal as it relates to basically the number one overall seed type conversation. But aside from that, you know, not significant. If the game ends in a three-goal margin either way, I don't think that the reaction coming away from it is going to be overly significant. The first thing that I would look to is that Connor Canizzaro was not dominant. He didn't have a dominating scoreline against Air Force. You don't expect that to be something that happens very frequently. So does he turn that game into a four-goal, four-assist game against Duke? So the first place I look is, what's Duke's approach going to be in terms of slowing him down defensively? And then the second is, you know, is this a game? It's not going to be a game where Trevor Baptiste is going to go 21-23 at the faceoff X. I refuse to believe. Kyle Rowe is too good. Duke is too athletic on the wings. It just doesn't seem likely. So now the question is, can Duke figure out a way to make the faceoff battle closer to 50%? Or is it going to be that 66-75% level for Baptiste? And you know, ultimately it's simple to say, but Denver is a team that can dominate the ball. They're content to play offense for a really long time. When they do get the ball, it can be frustrating for a defense. It can be frustrating for an offense to watch the ball at the other end of the field. I think that is, you know, kind of where the storyline unfolds. This Duke offense is pretty experienced. Once they do get the ball, will they be patient as they need to be and as they should be to take advantage of a Denver defense that to this point doesn't seem like it's as buttoned up as it was either at the end of last season or as you would expect it to be as the season goes along?
What do you think the tempo of this game is going to be?
I think it's going to be a really slow game. I think that, you know, I didn't see a tremendous amount of Duke pushing transition against Lehigh. Obviously, they almost got to 20 goals against High Point, and certainly that suggests that they have a lot of firepower. But what I saw Lehigh trying to push more transition against against Duke. I don't expect to see much of that out of Denver. I mean, like I said, you know, Denver is so mechanical in a good way, but they're mechanical in the sense that, like, one choice, one move begets the next move. They want to be in that system. They don't necessarily need to try to get two or three easy non-6-on-6 goals per game in order to get to the 10 to 12 goal threshold that they feel like they need to do to win, whereas a team like, for example, Loyola and Virginia, who I think as we continue to talk about them, I'll have some points to make about their transition offense going forward as well, has to make. So I think that, you know, the final score will not be an indicator of the tempo of the game. It'll be an indicator of how efficient the offenses were against the defenses. I think both offenses in the early going have the advantage over the defenses. And, you know, you could see a 13-12, 14, you know, 14-12 final, but it doesn't mean that you're looking at an 85 possession game.
So, number three, Duke. Number two, Denver, in our Cascade Maverick media poll. 3 o'clock Saturday at Kennesaw State. Will you be watching it on TV, Terry? Or watching the stream of it?
I'll be absolutely watching the live stream of this game.
Yeah, it's one every fan's going to want to watch.
This is actually going to be an interesting weekend for the live streams in the way that they stack up. Because you basically can go from 11:30 a.m. until about 6 p.m. In terms of watching live lacrosse.
Who's doing this game?
In terms of the broadcasters?
Yeah.
No, probably the local team.
Okay. Looking forward to that one. Notre Dame, our number one team in this week's poll, is opening up their season with Georgetown, number 14 Georgetown. What do you like in that one?
Well, I mean, there's really nothing that you can say about this because neither of these teams have played a game yet. That being said, I think the thing that I'm going to look for is and so here's my day on Saturday. I'm going to go to Loyola Hopkins, so I'm going to get there by 11:30 so that I'm able to watch the live stream of Georgetown Notre Dame in the press box at Loyola, watch the Loyola Hopkins game, and then I might be in the Loyola press box to watch Duke Denver afterwards. In this
they
one,
might not let you in that early.
They might not let me stay that late either. I'm going to have to put in some calls in order to be able to.
2.5 hours before game time.
Yeah, my alumni donation is going to have to pick up.
Yeah.
The thing I want to see is I want to see how physical Georgetown can be defensively, because I thought that last year under Kevin Warren, you saw their defensive competency increase. But I think that the next step in order to get to that Kevin Warren level defense that you saw out of Maryland in 2012 is to see those guys really throw some lumber, throw their body around, not in a way where they are willing to take needless fouls, but in a way where they can assert their set the tone and assert themselves physically. And I think that if that's what they try to do, you know, against a Notre Dame team that is incredibly tough. You know, Matt Kavanaugh with the injuries he played through last year, Mikey Wynn with the amount of times he got put on the deck after finishing a goal on the crease, Sergio Perkovic, who is one of the most physical present, you know, established physical presence in all of college lacrosse. That is a matchup that's going to be really fun and exciting to watch.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that one for sure. Next on the list, Cornell, Penn State.
Yeah, Jeff Tambroni's return to Ithaca. You know, another one in which there isn't a ton that you can say about it because we haven't seen Cornell yet. That being said, we've heard some rumblings out of Big Red camp in terms of the scrimmage results, etc. You know, I think that there's a little bit on edge there. Haven't necessarily played as well as you would have liked in the early going. But at the same time, you know, we talked a fair amount about the Chad Otterman arrival last week. Christian Knight did not play in the fall and had not played in the spring. But that being said, I don't know whether or not he's going to start against Penn State. And there are a couple of freshmen on offensively who I think, you know, particularly in Colton Rupp, but then also in Ryan Bray's case, there was a thought that they were going to be better than was originally anticipated upon their arrival. If all those things come to fruition and they take on a Penn State team who, you know, really needed an impressive fourth quarter to come back against Hobart and also, you know, won an in-state battle against a Robert Morris team that, you know, might not be all that good, this could very easily, it has the makings of a competitive game and one that I think will be very fascinating to examine the result of on this show next week.
Number five, Syracuse and Dylan Donahue take on Albany. big game upstate. Syracuse had a great start to their season. Donahue was fantastic in their opener. They put that one to bed pretty early.
Yep.
First quarter was pretty much over. Dominating faceoffs, large margin. What do you want to see in this one?
Well, so I think that, you know, again, Albany making their debut. The first thing you want to see is what their offense looks like without Lyle Thompson. Obviously, for Syracuse defensively, you know, they've got personnel that they can throw at in terms of matchup switches and stuff like that. You know, who Brandon Mullins is going to guard is not a foregone conclusion the way it would have been each of the last two seasons. That being said, I expect him to start on Connor Fields. I expect Connor Fields to roam from X. You know, I expect Seth Oates to be good on that righty wing. And then we'll see how the rest of their offense comes together. I think that Albany, like the Loyola and Virginia teams that we referenced earlier, is a team that's going to look to push and transition as opposed to be incredibly content in their 6-on-6, particularly against Syracuse. You know, and I want to see how Blaze Reardon plays. I mean, he's going to have to take on an even more substantial part of what Albany is. And, you know, does that mean he's a 60% goalie? I've spoken at length about how I don't know if Albany plays a style that allows him to be that. But if you can make a couple other plays that don't require, you know, that simple save percentage factor, you know, then he makes himself impactful in other ways, picking off passes around the goal, sparking a couple of transition runs. You know, the question is, I think Syracuse is a pretty clear favorite. Are they a 5-goal favorite or are they a 2-goal favorite? What is the expectation for how good, you know, Albany can be, particularly given the fact that Syracuse, number one, has a game under the belt and looked a little bit more impressive than I think most people expected heading into this game.
And you can see that game on Sunday at 4 o'clock. It's the lone ESPN 3 game of the weekend. Number 12 Albany in the dome against number 5 Syracuse. Which leads us, Terry, to our next game, the watch of the week. The game that I think is going to intrigue fans the most this weekend, besides the Duke Denver game. But it hits home for us. Mm-hmm. It's number 6 Johns Hopkins going over across town a little bit to play number 8 Loyola. And it's our alma mater's playing.
Yeah, that's right. So picking up the rivalry after a one-year hiatus, you know, credit to both coaching staffs for finding a way to work this out. The scheduling challenges that both face are real and understood. And even though it would be great if this was sundress weather, you know, we'll take the Greyhounds and the Blue Jays however we can get them. You know, I think, Dan, I don't know if you have felt this, but I, as a Loyola alum, have certainly felt the pendulum shift. Maybe the Greyhounds don't necessarily hold the prominence in this rivalry, but certainly they're not going into this game, you know, facing what at one point might have been one win in the previous 22 attempts or something like that.
Probably like 35.
Yeah, I think Loyola has won 2 of the last 3 meetings, and the one loss was their end of season loss in 2012 at the Ridley Athletic Complex. Their lone loss. In overtime, unbelievable. Probably one of the coolest lacrosse videos I've ever seen. It was the one that the 24/7 last guy shot the far sideline of scoring of the Loyola goal that sent the, you know, it was with like 2 seconds left. Was it Justin Ward that scored? Very, very late in the fourth quarter, and it sent the game to overtime. And the uproarious nature of the Loyola crowd is something that was just awesome. I mean, I was really, really pumped. But yeah, I mean, you know, so are you nervous?
I am nervous. I think Loyola scared me. Their result against Virginia scared me in a way that, you know, and Hopkins, you always are going to have a close game when you play at the Naval Academy, and I expected it to be close. Happy for the result, but I think that the Hopkins not having to play UMBC. Could help them this week. They'll be fresh. They'll be ready to play, maybe like a day or two extra to prepare for the Greyhounds. Whereas the Greyhounds had a very tough game last week, this past weekend, and I think that'll help Hopkins. It's going to be a close game, though. It's going to be a really close game.
That's some pretty heavy rationalization right there. I think that Loyola benefits from the confidence boost that they have in dismantling Virginia. And the thing that I took away that, you know, if I were Dave Petromala and his staff, that is probably the most surprising is not the right word, but the thing that I am preparing for that on Friday afternoon I probably wasn't as much ready to prepare for, is how much Loyola's offense can keep you back on your heels. So Brian Sherlock and Tyler Albrecht. I mean, I've made this analogy in many places. If you've heard it before, I apologize. But Brian Sherlock is a running back that plays lacrosse. And he actually was a running back at St. Anthony, so it's not a surprise that way. But he is just so, so aggressive. I tweeted that he his spin move looks like Dwight Freeney's spin move. He just attacks, attacks, attacks. But the thing that Loyola showed against Virginia that I didn't expect was freshman Patrick Spencer running the offense from X, finishing with two goals and two assists, and early on in the first quarter, beating Tanner Scales top side for a goal. So now you've got guys from both the top and the bottom that, as a defense, keep you back on your heels because you're just a little bit afraid that they're going to run past you. It's something that they didn't have last year, and it's something that I think, you know, once the ball gets into the Loyola offensive end, it's going to be a real part of the story of this game.
Who covers Ryan Brown?
It's going to be David Manning. And I think that it's an interesting matchup because Manning, is after missing 2015 with an ACL tear, it's easy to give a fair amount of the credit for Loyola's impressive defensive performance to him. You know, it was interesting because heading into the 2015 season, I thought that how you replace Joe Fretcher is really the biggest story for Loyola. I thought Pat Frazier had a really nice season. He was a disruptive player. He was able to get out and extend on people's hands. But Loyola defensively just didn't have it. They weren't able to make timely stops. You know, I remember that Georgetown game in particular. It was just like, man, they don't look good in transition defense. They don't necessarily look that good in 6-on-6. Where are these shortcomings? Where are these flaws, and how do you fix them? Well, in the early going, it looks like David Manning is as a senior coming back. I was surprised. I wasn't surprised to see Jason Crane starting. You know, he's another experienced player who has played a lot of pole and played a lot of close defense as well, so it made a little bit of sense. But the sophomore, number 20 for Loyola, who made his debut, Foster Huggins, sophomore out of Dallas, Texas. I was surprised to see him start, but he played well. And so I thought that from a personnel perspective, Loyola looked good. Thought that their shorties looked okay. They looked improved. Ryan Fournier remains an asset for the Greyhounds. He had a goal. And they just start, like I said, I mean, I think the biggest thing was that, like, it came out of Grant Lamone. Grant Lamone looked a lot like Jack Runkle. That's the way that Loyola's defense looks its best, when you've got a goalie that's literally eating up shots.
So we know you'll be at Loyola all day on Saturday, it sounds like. Do you have a prediction for this game?
I don't get to do that whole, like, Kirk Herbstreit, I'm going to be there, so it doesn't, yeah. I mean, right now I feel like a one-goal Loyola win. Why are you feeling?
I feel a one-goal game. Win? But, yeah, I like the Blue Jays.
All right, perfect. There you go. That's exactly what it's supposed to be.
No, home one goal, you got to score?
Oh.
High score, low score? I originally wrote 8-7 Hopkins, and I think I reconsidered 11-10 Hopkins.
Oh, wow. I was actually thinking like 10-9. I was thinking right in the middle
there. I think it'll be 11-10.
Okay.
And that game is our watch of the week, and if you can't make it over to Ridley, you can watch it on Patriot League TV at 1 o'clock through the Loyola website.
Absolutely. Dan, this was really fun.
Yeah.
Thank you for having me in your home.
Yeah, thanks for coming over and allowing us to get this done.
Special shout out to your family for accommodating this disruption in your Monday afternoon.
That's okay. You're welcome.
On to week 3.
Yes.
Enjoy, folks. Thanks for listening. Once again, send us an email, tfloyd@insidelacrosse.com, dflynn@insidelacrosse.com. We ratcheted up the music this week. We will ratchet up the technical components going forward. And, you know, theoretically, we'll come up with some more ideas. But, you know, throw us some feedback, ask us a question, and we'll start getting this thing going.
See you next week, guys.